Well, good morning and Happy New Year to all of you, to all of us. Let it be good, the coming one. Let us be good, the coming one. I always, when I think of New Year at Purim in the mountains in Austria. We sit there in a little log cabin, and it's dark, it's all candle lit for a week. And during that week, everyone collects firewood so that on New Year's night, which will be tonight for everyone for now, there's a long sit and then a little tea. And then a shorter sit while people take turns going downstairs to where the big log is hanging and the big bell is hanging. And you swing the log back and boom, 108 times. Everybody gets a turn to do three or four. So I always feel like a child thinking, oh, can I do some more? It's so fun. And after that, we go out into the snow, put on our snow clothes first, and then go marching out into the snow and up a steep hill. And there's the fire ready. And they start the fire, and it blazes up, and Vanya shows up with his brother and two big dogs and paper balloons. He lights a light under the paper balloons, and they all go floating up into the millions and millions of stars over the mountains and disappears. And then they pass around a little schnapps, and everybody has a sip. And then we go back and go to sleep around 2 o'clock in the morning. So, I know you're doing something here.
Something.
There aren't any mountains here, so it won't be so dramatic, but the sitting part is probably the most important. It's a wonderful way to set the mind for time, the time that we're in, and remember over and over where we are and when we are, so that we don't lose our way. The other day, a friend took me to San Francisco. Big adventure for me, it's been a long time. And we went to the Asian Art Museum. And it's been ages since I've seen it, so I was looking with big eyes and amazed at how many Buddhas there are. They're just room after room of big Buddhas and little teeny ones, and the child Buddha, and they all have a little smile. Almost all of them. There's one that doesn't have a smile, but all the rest of them do. And they're bodhisattvas galore. And there's Prajnaparamita, who is the mother of Buddha, a very tall, beautiful woman standing, serene. It was really inspiring to see so many. There's a China room, a Tibet room, a Thai room, Japan room, and they're all a little bit different. There are the Buddhas from India, some of which are very primitive, and some of which look like they were made in Greece, because Alexander the Great marched into India, and somebody taught the artists in Gandhara how to make very lifelike, very beautiful, and artistic. Some of them have mustaches. Maitreya has a big mustache. Very charming. So it was inspiring to see how we try to create something on which to project, which is what those things are. That's what the Buddha is up there. It's not that we're worshiping an idol exactly. It's just a recognition. Oh, I know that in me. I feel that. I remember that feeling. So we don't forget. When I was traveling in India with the intention of going with my husband into the farming country, we went to Deer Park. And there's a beautiful, beautiful statue of Buddha, the most beautiful one I've ever seen. And I just stood there, transfixed for a long time. And the guide said to me, "Does that mean something to you?" And I said, "Well, yes." And he said, "Why are you going to the farm country when you could be going to the Buddha places instead?" So he fixed me up and sent me off to the Buddha places, and my husband went to help people get water out of a river with his invention. So a statue can be deeply moving without being an object. We overcome the thingification of things. As we take it in. And it's practice for our practice entirely as we allow things to come in. Beautiful things and difficult things. There were also statues, many more than I had ever imagined, of in Buddhist time, it was Mara. But in our time, we call it a demon. So there were many, many demons. And I think most of them were some kind of depiction of Mara. Mara, who was the one who tempted Buddha when he was sitting under the tree. Buddha went through many, many austerities, penances, it was called in the old stories, trying to drive his body out of itself to transcend this physical limitation that we are, this messy humanness, and somehow achieve complete connection with up there. And Mara is a part of our human realm in the Indian understanding of us, of Buddhism. And Mara is always up there as a part of the operation of us as humans. Mara meaning temptation to power, to greed, to licentiousness. To battle, all the things that, of course, we carry around, as well as our kindness and compassion and wisdom and all those things. We are such a mix. We like to become pure. We struggle toward purity, and that's what Buddha was doing. He was making an effort toward total purity. And it wasn't working. Try as he could, he couldn't. He would get up and he was just the same, only weaker and weaker. He was eating as much only as much as one grain of rice a day. And finally, when he gave up, he was offered some food and he sat down. And sitting down, Mara showed up. So the demon is in the original story. The question is how we deal with our demons. And Buddha gave us a great way of doing it. He said, I see you. I see you, Mara. He brought his three gorgeous daughters and had them dance a very sexy dance, offered them to him. And Buddha said, I see you. And Mara said, ah, he sees me. And he immediately goes away. The amazing thing is that, counter to how we might think about Buddha, Mara kept showing up in his life for all the years until he died. You can't get rid of it. Sorry. I'm really sorry. We can't get pure like that. There is no such thing. And in fact, we can get in a lot of trouble if we try too hard for an impossibility, expect too much. The important thing is to be able to see it when it's happening, to actually acknowledge and accept that the temptation is there. And some of them are obvious, it's so simple. Of course, I'm not going to try to get piles and piles of gold and silver are some of the things that he was dealing with. But the subtle things that show up in our life are hard to see sometimes. You could say a demon is dangling them in front of us. It's Mara saying, look, look, how about this? And you say, oh yes, no, I see you. I see you. Buddha had wonderful encounters. One time he told Mara, I'll break your squadrons with understanding, like breaking a clay pot with a stone. So the only way is understanding. I get it. Oh, that's how it's working. Huh, not such a good idea. Once he told Mara, I've attained enlightenment. I'm free of all those penances. And Mara said, you've left the ascetic path by which to purify yourself. You're not pure. You think you are. The path of purity is far from you. And he said, I know these penances to gain deathlessness are vain as ship's oars and rudder in dry land. With development of virtue, concentration, understanding, I've reached enlightenment, and you are vanquished. He knows me. He knows me. Somebody wrote a poem about demons once called called working to get rid of a demon? Sit very still. Listen. Be brave. Make music of the demon's voice. Say, I hear your song. It's beautiful. Sit very still. Watch. Be brave. See the demon clearly. Sleeves and hems, hair, especially eyes. Say, I see you, demon. You are a myth with a voice. Sit very still. Wait. Be brave. Watch incense smoke curl and rise. Say, demon, rise with this smoke and go. Now, allow this demon, although you cling to it, to go. So that is the tricky part, that many of our best intentions are, of course, undermined by our greed, hate, and delusion. It's how we're made. And the only way we can deal with it is to know it, understand it well, see it. And not just for once and all. There is no once for all, ever. There is only the moment we're in, and only how much aware we are that we can actually face the reality of our life as it is. So Mara is still sitting up there in the divine realm, sitting over us. Stephen Batchelor made an opera about Mara. I haven't heard the music, but it must be quite amazing. The interesting thing about this whole thing is that, having grown up in a Christian tradition, where we're told about sin, this isn't about sin. This is just about human nature. It isn't that we're doomed at all. In fact, our own nature, the reality of our own nature, saves us already. We say we're going to save all sentient beings. All the sentient beings of my mind. Every sentient being is a thought in us. We ourselves are a thought in everyone, and we ourselves are thinking ourselves. So the amazing thing about this is that we can be aware of how we think, aware of how we are creating a life and a world, as well as existing in one. It's simultaneous and very strange and very mysterious. It's, in the end, very hard to understand. But Buddhism gives us just enough to find our seat, our place, our time. If we just sit down and be, suddenly there, everything falls away. All those things. When we get up, it all rushes in again. But sitting, we begin to realize in the silence and the peace of it, there's a whole possibility and opportunity for us that sometimes we overlook. So our sitting practice is essential. And so are the precepts. They sound like instructions with a shaking finger saying you should do this and this and this, but it's not that. It's just that if we know them, if we know that we agreed not to kill or to steal or to lie, all those things Mara is inviting us to do, if we're aware of it, then we can just say, I see you. I see you. And the paramitas about generosity and vigor and the precepts and meditation, all these things are just helping us to put our life together in one place and just be this one thing, which is so miraculous. So on this new year, I'm wishing all of us as much wisdom and compassion and understanding and insight and trust. Because life is not easy. It's never easy. I've lived long enough to know that now. I can swear to it. So practice doesn't make life more easy. In fact, it opens us to the real suffering in the world. But it offers us the opportunity, if we're willing, to do something. At Autumn, our practice is about activity, the action of sitting and the action of standing up and doing something about it, whatever it is. We don't go to sleep in Buddhist practice. We wake up. We wake up big time. So as we go into this new year, this 18, I wish us all a very big waking up. Thank you. Is there time for questions?
There's time.
Oh, okay. Questions, comments?
Thank you, Angie. I like your word, I think it was thingamication. I don't recall quite what you were saying just before you used it, but you were saying that you had to catch a process of thingamication. Sounded like you were getting to some gap where you would be able to see what options were available, and I guess what I want to say is, can you speak some more about that communication?
What I meant by that is that in idol worship, you make the thing a real thing, and then you as a real thing. So there are two things, and I was trying to point to that there aren't two things. So if we confront something that is an object that is representing something that touches us, the being touched is the action of what we're meeting, which is the same as wave between, you could say, of every meeting, so that we don't objectify. We take it in, you could say.
That seems somehow connected to the idea of a fixed view of a thing or a concept or a belief.
Yes.
It's thingified, it's fixed, it's objectified or reified.
Good way to say it, yes. When I had lunch with Coben, my teacher, our teacher, he would pick up each object with such care, such respect, because it too is part of the thing between. It too, like everything actually that we touch and see, is that way. We're so fast and we're so American, we just haul ourselves around and sling things around, but if you practice long enough, you begin to put things down more carefully. You don't drop the spoon or clatter the plate, or at least you try more to be more careful, not because you're supposed to, but because the plate itself is important, just as important as you are. It's your world and your life and its life. And we begin to see things more deeply. It's all falling apart, just as we are. But it's also an expression of what we can't say. That's a good question, Eiko.
How do you differentiate consciousness from intelligence?
Well, you can be conscious without being, I would say, wise. Intelligence is just using your wisdom, which is curiosity, and I'm sure in science there's a way of making that distinction, but I would say wisdom, insight, willingness to be curious. It's alive. Intelligence is alive. Consciousness can be sound asleep. We can be get up and brush our teeth in the morning, but we can be not there at all. And often are, at least in my case, drifting around the house thinking something else, and then wake up, oh my gosh, here I am. So the more we can wake up and be there, the better. And that's the intelligent or the wise cultivation, because then we can see when something rises, we can say, I see you. When something important arises, we can go out to meet it and offer ourselves to it.
Mindfulness, basically.
Mindfulness, you could say, yeah. Yes.
What about what you said about, you know, I see you. I feel like I have a good grasp of what it is to do that. I shouldn't say that. Easy as I say I have a grasp of anything, but that concept isn't as confusing to me to say, you know, okay, I'm having this feeling of shame. Like, oh, I see you. I can understanding part, where I get caught up in is if I try to understand, I get very into thinking. You know, I go, oh, I see shame. What's that about? Then I get into this very convoluted, long, word-based. And it's like, is that really how to understand? Is there a different mechanism?
Sometimes that's important. It's important to cultivate your thought and your understanding through thinking. But you can start making up a story that goes on and becomes a compulsion. You have to keep telling it over and over, and that's no use at all. So it's up to us, I think, to make distinctions like that. Notice when we're really need to knuckle down and figure something out, and times when we've done that already and need to let it go. That's one of the ways that life is a little difficult, because it calls on us to make decisions like that over and over. We have to develop skillfulness, knowing ourselves well enough that we know how to do that. But it's also very interesting. Now, you learn a lot. First about yourself, and the more you know about yourself, the more you know about other people. So it's very helpful. Thank you. Daniel?
Question about like practicality of applying the I see you. It's like sometimes when I have like a temptation or something, like the cloud of greed comes up, I say I see you, but I don't feel like it's always strong enough. I'm like, I find myself going back to it. So would you recommend setting aside a period of like 10 minutes, for example, to sit down after you've become conscious of Mara so that you can wake up to it more?
Possibly. It depends on what the issue is. No, you can, Mara can come to you and suggest an ice cream cone, which you think is really the wrong thing to do, and you go ahead and do it. It really depends on what the situation is. And if you do get the ice cream cone, you don't need to lash yourself. It's not a big deal. It's just, this is all an opportunity for us to know ourselves and how our mind is at work and how we are at the same time as we're human beings stumbling along. We're being lived. And so the more we notice ourself, the more we notice that how we are doing is not entirely ourself, that we are lived through, you could say. So it's okay. You know, anything really comes out is okay. This isn't a moral discussion so much as a discussion of just how to stay in one place and then see what happens. You can just develop enough curiosity to and forgiveness. If you can forgive yourself, you can forgive other people too. So it's all connected in that way.
Thanks for being here. I'm wondering if you've ever felt like, you don't have to answer this, if you've ever felt like you don't know how to practice suddenly.
Yeah.
And it's as if you just completely started over. Oh, I think that's how I want to ask that.
That you don't know how to practice anymore. That you did know at one time, and you don't know anymore.
Like it may have worked at some point.
Yes. What did it do?
Well, it's really funny. I mean, I guess I have to give a personal answer to that. At some point, I felt like, especially like in the first years of practice, there was the reason why I kept at it was that there was something happening.
Yes.
I felt there was a spaciousness, a willingness to accommodate situations that may not have been, that didn't seem that possible before that. Like being with someone, like my dying grandfather, or whatever was arising in my life, with a sense of spaciousness, a sense of immediacy, yet just being there.
Yeah.
And suddenly, not even sure if that's possible. You know, not even just what was up is now down, what was down is now up, and it's completely up.
That's really good. Because it's not about you. So when we first start to practice, it's all about me. And for good reason. I mean, it's stunning. We discover a whole new life and world in our own mind that we didn't know was there. And it's wonderful, and we want a lot of it. We want more. It's so yummy. But it's just a way that we learn about ourselves. It's I don't want to say stage because it doesn't go in stages, but it happens after you've gotten enough of the yummy stuff. You have to just let it go. And not be special. Not be different. Because you're not. However, because you practice, you bring to every encounter something that you didn't have before. That your ability to be with other people or other things creates a situation that is saving, you could say. That you're making things happen by your very being. Each of us is. And the more we practice, the more effect we have, even though we're not doing it anymore. We see we're not doing it. It's just happening. So we don't get any merit, we don't get any points, we don't get anything. Coben always says it's just this one more stepping down. And yet there's joy in it. Coben said when he was practicing, sometimes he would sit that way and nothing was happening, and he would say, oh, Zazen, please come to me, come to me. And nothing would happen. He said it was so frustrating. It just does happen that way. And the more we want something else, the farther away anything else would be. It's just another opportunity for cultivating desire. Give me more. If you allow yourself to trust yourself that it's all there, always, was from the beginning, always will be. You don't have to get anywhere or anything. Aren't we lucky? Maybe that's enough. Thank you all.